We'll be reading from the great Oscar Wilde later tonight. But let's begin with some of the weirdos that have called in recently. You know who you are. Let's try this one.
Okay, that was so weird. Somebody just like hung up on me. I think there's somebody there. This thing is really haunted. What? Okay, I thought I heard somebody talk. Shit, I see something wrong with me. I've been hallucinating for the whole past day, so.
Oh!
This person doesn't even know the same middle school as they used to. Now I'm going to Pomona. Come on now. Okay, have fun. Yay! Free time!
That's right.
Then you go to 4.
You're a fucking asshole.
Me too!
So I went to the U.S. Army Signal Corps back in 1984. And then I left like I was at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And I was 72 Acro. We had like a big clearance.
You're a fucking asshole.
Look who the Germans come.
You're a fucking asshole.
The questions they say, were you ever treated as
a fucking asshole? You're a fucking asshole. You're a fucking asshole.
So my grandfather owned an auto body shop in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, which is also owned by Organized Crime.
Oh,
and I don't know if it's not the audio or not. And then they had like knocking on them from like the old West. In that period, like a lot of gun camp in the old West. Then he got a model that made shotgun. We had papers for him. Let's make a long story short. He went out of business, like the auto body shop went out of business, and one day some guy came up to Organized Crime. And he wasn't the guy who paid money for it, because he shot him. Then they got rid of the body. I don't know what happened. Positive. But after World War II, And on the top of it, they have like a pigeon where they keep pigeons, and it's like supposed to be a gangster restaurant, and it's supposed to be like five-star dining in Park, New York. So we assume that, and then maybe the producers, the Hitler guy, in the movie, who thought he was going to take care of pigeons, that was the pigeon food, because the Jews, the Jewish, I suppose, in the United States, wanted to know who was the Nazi. And my grandfather was a dirt pile, so they couldn't really arrest him. But the German government had a book. But they made this movie to produce it, which is based on the pigeon food at Don Pepe.
Suffering is one very long moment. We cannot divide it by seasons. We can only record its moods and chronicle their returns. With us, time itself does not progress. It revolves. It seems to circle round one center of pain, the paralyzing mobility of life.
In fact,
every circumstance of which is regulated after an unchangeable
pattern,
right,
idea about Telstar's
so that we eat and drink and lie down and
less
pray,
than 2 weeks after the first test,
at least
the U.S.
prayer,
networks
according
joined
to the
forces
inflexible
with
laws
six broadcasters
of an iron formula.
First ever,
this immobile quality that makes each dreadful day in the very minute's detail like a brother seems to communicate itself to those external Europe forces, right, the very now, essence of its existence is ceaseless change.
Let's give all the
of seed time or harvest,
Europe,
of the reapers bending over the corn, or the grape gatherers threading through the vines.
The Americans
of
showed
grass
Europe
in the
baseball game
and white
the press conference by President Kennedy.
BBC's
Richard Dimbleby introduced pictures of Big Ben
nothing,
and a concert
for us there
in
is only one
chat
season.
You see, look,
the season
you
of
see
sorrow,
fact, Vatican City,
the very sun and moon seem taken from us. Outside the day may be blue and gold, but the light that drips down through the thickly muffled clay glass.
We see here as we hear them the glories of my collection. This one of the world's treasures, the peak of man's its artistic achievement. Christ, in all his glory,
does it quite well.
Around him, the city.
Television viewers were entranced by
the idea.
Now watching the live anywhere in Europe or America. It was all down to Telstar, the only satellite to have a pop song written in its honour.
The name Telstar is an extremely good name to be used for public relations purposes.
A week later, I am transferred here. 3 more months go over and my mother dies. No one knew how deeply I loved and honoured her. Her death was terrible to me, but I, once lord of language, have no words in which to express my anguish and my shame. She and my father had refused me a name. They had made me noble and honored, not merely in literature, art, archaeology, and science.
In that edition of Witness, Alex was talking to Simon Watts. And if you'd like to listen to more of our history programmes, go to bbcworldservice.com/...
I was a man who stood in symbolic relations to the art and culture of my age. I had realized this for myself at the very dawn of my manhood, and had forced my age to realize it afterwards. Few men hold such a position in their lifetime and have it so acknowledged. It is usually discerned, if discerned at all, by the historian or the critic long after both the man and his age have passed away. With me it was different. I felt it myself and made others feel it. Mine were to something more noble, more permanent, and more vital issue of larger scope. The gods had given me almost everything, but I let myself be lured into long spells of senseless and sensual ease. I amused myself with being a flaneur, a dandy, a man of fashion. I surrounded myself with the smaller natures and meaner minds. I became the spendthrift of my own genius, and to waste an eternal youth gave me curious joy. Tired of being on the heights, I deliberately went to the depths in the search for new sensation. When the paradox was to me the sphere of thought, perversity became to me in the sphere of passion. Desire at the end was a malady or a madness or both. I grew careless of the lives of others. I took pleasure where it pleased me and passed on. I forgot that every little action of the common day makes or unmakes character, and that therefore what one has done in the secret chamber, one has done day to cry aloud on the housetop. I ceased to be lord over myself. I was no longer the captain of my soul and did not know it. I allowed pleasure to dominate me. I ended in horrible disgrace. There is only one thing for me now. Absolute humility. I must learn how to be happy. Once I knew it, or thought I knew it by instinct. It was always springtime once in my heart. My temperament was akin to joy. I filled my life to the very brim with pleasure, as one might fill a cup to the very brim with wine. Now I am approaching life from a completely new standpoint, and even to conceive happiness is often extremely difficult for me. I used to live entirely for pleasure. I shunned suffering and sorrow of every kind. I hated both. I resolved to ignore them as far as possible, to treat them, that is to say, as modes of imperfection. They were not part of my scheme of life. They had no place in my philosophy.
My mother, who knew life as a whole, used to often quote to me Goethe's lines, written by Carlyle in a book he had given her years ago, and translated by him, I fancy, also. Who never ate his bread in sorrow, who never spent the midnight hours weeping and waiting for the morrow, he knows you not, ye heavenly powers. I now see that sorrow, being the supreme emotion of which man is capable, is at once the type and test of all great art. When the artist is always looking for the mode of existence in which soul and body are one and indivisible, in which the outward is the expressive of the inward, in which form reveals, of such modes of existence there are not a few. Youth and the arts preoccupied with youth may serve as a model for us at one moment. At another, we may like to think that in its subtlety and sensitiveness of impression, its suggestion of a spirit dwelling in external things and making its raiment of earth and air, of mist and city alike, and in its morbid sympathy of its moods and tones and colors, modern landscape art is realizing for us pictorially what was realized in such plastic perfection by the Greeks. Music in which all subject is absorbed in expression and cannot be separated from it is a complex example, and a flower or a child a simple example of what I mean. But sorrow is the ultimate type both in life and art. Behind joy and laughter there may be a temperament coarse, hard, and callous, but behind sorrow there is always sorrow. Pain, unlike pleasure, wears no mask. Truth in art is not any correspondence between the essential idea and the accidental existence. It is not the resemblance of shape to shadow, or of the form mirrored in the crystal to the form itself. It is no echo coming from a hollow hill any more than it is a silver well of water in the valley that shows the moon to the moon and narcissus to narcissus. Truth in art is the unity of a thing with itself, the outward rendered expressive of the inward, the soul made incarnate, the body instinct with the spirit. For this reason, there's no truth comparable to sorrow. There are times when sorrow seems to me to be the only truth. Other things may be illusions of the eye or the appetite, made to blind the one and cloy the other. But out of sorrow have the words been built, and at the birth of a child or a star, there is pain. More than this, there is about sorrow an intense and extraordinary reality. I have said to myself that I was one who stood in symbolic relations to the art and culture of my age. There is not a single wretched man in this wretched place along with me who does not stand in symbolic relation to the very secret of life. For the secret of life is suffering. It is what is hidden behind everything. When we begin to live, what is sweet is so sweet to us, and what is bitter so bitter, that we inevitably direct all our desires towards pleasures and seek not merely for a month or twain to feed on honeycomb, but for all years to taste no other food, ignorant all the while that we may really be starving the soul. I remember talking once on this subject to one of the most beautiful personalities I have ever known, a woman whose sympathy and noble kindness to me, both before and since the tragedy of my imprisonment, have been beyond power and description, one who has really assisted me, though she does not know it, to bear the burden of my troubles more than anyone else in the world has. And although the mere fact of her existence, through her being what she is, partly an ideal and partly an influence, a suggestion of one might become, as well as a real help towards becoming it, a soul that renders the common air sweet and makes what is spiritual seem as simple and natural as sunlight or the sea, one for whom beauty and sorrow walk hand in hand and have the same message. On the occasion of which I'm thinking, I recall distinctly how I said to her that there was enough suffering in one narrow lane to show that God did not love man, and that wherever there was any sorrow, though but that of a child in some little garden weeping over a fault that it had or had not committed, the whole face of creation was completely marred. I was completely wrong. She told me so, but I could not believe her. I was not in the sphere in which such belief was to be attained to. Now it seems to me that love of some kind is the only possible explanation of the extraordinary amount of suffering that there is in the world. I cannot conceive of any other explanation. I am convinced there is no other, and that if the world has indeed, as I have said, been built of sorrow, it has been built by the hands of love, because no other way could the soul of man for whom the world was made reach the full stature of its perfection. Pleasure for the beautiful body, but pain for the beautiful soul. Oscar Wilde.
Finally, I got my own computer. I was so psyched to explore a whole new world. I just don't feel normal. My friends are nice, but they just don't get me.
I feel like such a weirdo!
Go to be understood. I found this online show. I can call in. I can express myself. Be on TV. Weirdos TV. Weirdos.com. Sometimes a stranger can be your best friend.
His name is Freedom.